we've had some fun times this weekend, right? It's already, I can't believe it's already almost done. It's kind of sad that it's almost done. We've talked about a couple of things. Actually, you know what? I've heard that there's some rumblings in the camp, okay? There has been some conversations about me. And I just want to set the record straight so you can just stop thinking about it and focus on the Lord. Yes, I was wearing underwear when I pulled my pants down, okay? So let's just stop that topic of conversation, get your hearts right with the Lord, and let's move on. Okay, God, please let your spirit stay. Sorry. But we've had some fun, and we've talked about, you know, last night we talked about the importance of abiding. We've talked about the importance of changing your soundtrack. We talked about private pain. This morning, Portia talked about surrendering strengths. She could not have set me up any better. I'm telling you, she talked about her strengths, but she forgot one very important one, the gift of prophecy. She is a prophetic voice, and she does it in such a gentle way, in such a way that you just allow the Lord to speak whatever she is speaking over you. You know, too often we think the prophetic is weird. We think the prophetic is you have to be super spiritual. All the prophetic is calling out what God is already doing, what God has planned already. And so for you planners, prophetic is for you, okay? If you like to plan, the prophetic is for you. But we talked about all these things, and I want to get right into it because we don't have a lot of time, but I am a story lover. If you didn't tell last night, I love stories. I love to read books. I love to watch movies. I love how a good conflict ends with a good conclusion. And I think the reason I am that way, and I think the reason maybe you feel that way, is because we were made for a happy ending. We were made for heaven. And so we were made to long for the happily ever after. We were made to watch the underdog get what they deserve, right? We love that happy ending. And I think that's the satisfaction of watching shows, a good show. I love to binge watch, this is probably a really bad admission, but I love to binge watch series on Netflix and Hulu, Disney Plus, I don't care what it is. But if it's a series that starts with the first season and goes all the way to the finale, that's my favorite. Because I get to watch the beginning, to the middle, to the end, right? But that's not where most of us live in life. Most of us live in a constant state of highs and lows, but it's kind of the middle that we camp out in. It's kind of the middle that we kind of stay in, right? And the middle can be filled of a lot of feelings. It can be filled with stuck. You're feeling stuck. You can feel scary. You can feel lonely. You can feel lost. You can feel rejected, judged, misunderstood. You can feel done. And the word middle simply means being neither at the beginning nor the end of a series. And the middle is a place that we can find ourselves for a variety of reasons. Maybe something life has done to us. COVID is a really good example of that. We've been stuck in the middle of life with COVID, right? Or maybe something someone else has done to us. You're stuck in the middle because of something someone else has done. Or maybe something you have done to yourself. But no matter why you find yourself stuck in the middle of something, you have a lot of feelings, anger, anxiety, abandonment, bitterness, confused, resentment. And the Bible is full of middles. The Bible is full of middles, but it's full of miracles. Of people who once were stuck in their middle too. Once were stuck in a place where they had no way of overcoming. They were stuck in a place where they didn't know what the answer was. And just like a good book or a good series, we have the benefit of watching, of reading their stories from the beginning to the middle to the end, from the entirety. But I think when you go to the middle of these characters' stories in the Bible, when you focus on the middle of their situation, that's when we can really relate to them. That's when we can really resonate with them. The long, cold night that Daniel sat in the lion's den, having no way of knowing what was going to happen. We get the benefit of reading, he was thrown in the lion's den and he came out the next day. But we don't always think about the fact that he had no idea. He didn't know what was going to happen. He had to have been feeling some feelings of angerment. Angerment. There's a new word for you guys. Write that down. Anger. He must have been feeling maybe abandoned. Maybe fear. Or that day that Joseph was sold into slavery. by his brothers. He didn't know what was going to happen. As he was led away in chains, he must have been feeling a little bit of betrayal, loneliness, maybe misunderstood. Or what about the moment that Moses was stuck between the Red Sea and the Egyptians coming? He didn't know what was going to happen. And so he had to have been feeling stuck, overwhelmed, confused. It's like, God, you called us here. What's going on? Because as a leader, we can feel those feelings, right? Because we're human, like we talked about last night. And I think we have so much in common with these heroes when we go to the middle of their story and we look at their story from the perspective of the middle. All three of these heroes and so many more heroes of the Bible have for sure one thing in common, and that is they were intentional in their middle. They were intentional in their middle. And so that's where I want to linger for a little bit today, because I don't care where you are, what you're living in, I know that you are stuck in the middle somewhere in a situation that you are praying for, you're believing God an answer for. There is something that is going on in your life that you need him to show up. And so today, I want to talk to you about being intentional in your middle when, one, there's nothing you can do. Two, you want others to get their due. And three, it's important what you do. It should be up there. So hopefully, if you guys are taking notes, my note-taking friends, it should be up there somewhere. When there's nothing you can do, when you want others to get their due, and when it's important what you do. So number one, how to be intentional in your middle when there's nothing you can do. Because a good leader does the right thing even when there's a consequence. The right leader, or a good leader, does the right thing even when there's a consequence, because they know that good leadership, in good leadership, character development keeps pace with skill development. And so you're willing to do the right thing even when there is a consequence. And one of the most famous Bible stories in the Bible is Daniel in the lion's den. Here's a man who, he was stuck in the middle of his story because he did the right thing. And there was a consequence. He was stuck in his middle and there was nothing he could do. Now, a little backstory on him. He lived in Babylon and he rose to the highest palace by Darius the Mede, King Darius. King Darius loved Daniel. And so he had some jealous rivals. And these jealous rivals hated Daniel because of just who he was and how King Darius favored him. And so they got together and they decided that they were going to do something about their hatred. And so they tricked King Darius into issuing a decree that for 30 days, no one in that land should pray to anyone but King Darius himself. No God, no person, no thing. And they knew that Daniel would not do this because they knew that Daniel had this love and devotion to the one true God. And so they tricked King Darius into issuing this decree, and that if anyone said, and if anyone prayed to anyone other than King Darius, they would be thrown into the lion's den. So of course, Daniel did not adhere to this law, and he was thrown into the lion's den. And as the story goes, the next day, we know, because we get the benefit of reading from the beginning to the middle to the end, he's thrown in the lion's den, and he came out the next day. But what if we go to Daniel? What if we look at Daniel in the middle of his story? Did you know that, this is a side note, did you know that Daniel was 80 years old? The Bible scholars say that he was about 80 years old when he was thrown into the lion's den. Don't ever think that you've missed it, that you are too beyond, that you're too old to be a part of one of the greatest miracles ever told. God's got a plan every single time in your life, no matter where you are. But what if we had a chance to talk to him during that long night, his night of his unknown, as he sat in the lion's den, having no idea if these mouths would open and he would be devoured? In 2019, Doug and I had the privilege of going over to Israel, and one of the days they took us to a cave that they said would be much like a den that would be held with lions. The lions stayed in these caves, okay? And we walked in, and It wasn't at all what I was thinking. I mean, when I was little, I had this whole picture of Daniel in the lion's den. You know, you throw him down into the den. And actually, it was more like a cave-like structure that you walked into. We walked in, and you could see, like, all these different coves and chambers, rooms, if you will, of this cave. And I sat down, and they rolled, a tomb type of thing, a stone, over the entrance. And it got dark immediately. Like, I could barely see my hand in the front of my face. And I couldn't hear... I mean, I couldn't see, but I could hear everything. Like, I could hear the rustling around of people in the different coves and different chambers. I could hear their breathing. I could hear their whispering. Like, my ears perked. I could hear everything. I couldn't see anything, but I could hear everything. And I sat there, and I thought, what did Daniel feel like when he was sitting in the cave much like this, having no idea what was going to happen? He could hear everything. He could hear everything. He didn't know what was going to happen. He didn't know. He didn't have the benefit of reading that God shut the mouths of the lions. We don't know if God said, don't worry, Daniel, I got this. We don't know. But we know that he could probably hear a lot. He could hear the snarls and the growls and the whistling of their tails and their paws. And I mean, the Bible doesn't tell us this, but I'm going to take a little leeway, okay? These mouths of these lions were shut. And so do you think they were happy? You think they're like... I mean, when I was little, I kind of pictured these sweet little lions curled up next to Daniel sleeping. They were ticked. I guarantee it. And so what was he thinking on this night as he was listening, waiting for their mouths to devour him? Was he feeling unwavering faith? Was he feeling fear? Was he questioning God? I did the right thing and here I am. We don't know because we don't have the benefit of reading that part. But if we put ourselves in his position, we can probably guess. You could probably guess a little bit of what he was feeling. He did the right thing, and here he was stuck. He was stuck in the middle of his story, and there was nothing he can do. But I think if we could talk to Daniel right there in the middle, just because of his character, just because of how he was so devoted to God, I think he would tell us to trust. To trust God, to trust that God is good in the middle. God's got this in the middle, and he's with us. And of course, he did get his miracle. He walked out unscathed the next morning. But it's because he waited for God to show up. And God not only showed up, but God showed off, which is how God always does it. He not only shows up, but he will show off. And so how are you intentional? How should you be intentional in your middle when there's nothing you can do? Trust that God will show up, because he will. He has proved himself over and over and over. So what about when you're stuck in the middle and you want others to get their due? We're human, after all, right? When something happens to us, we want to see God get them good. Sometimes we even pray for that. Get them, God. Get them. So what should you do when you're stuck in the middle of something because of someone else? When you are stuck to endure the consequences of someone else's actions. Now, Joseph, here's a guy who was very familiar with that. Joseph he was the second youngest of 12 sons of Jacob. And the Bible tells us he was the favorite. Any favorites in here? I'm raising my hand because I know I am. And let's just say... Well, his dad made him a coat of many colors. Any Dolly Parton fans in here? Back through the years, I go wondering once again. My mom and dad used to make me sing that song to all my great aunt and uncles at every party. So embarrassing, but that's another song stuck in my head. Anytime I hear a coat of many colors, I'm singing it. My coat of many colors that my mama made for me. Anyways, so his dad makes him this coat of many colors because he's the favorite. And Joseph isn't one of those... who probably handles his favoritism very well, I don't think. I mean, he has a dream about his brothers bowing down to him, and then he tells his brothers, you're going to bow down to me. So I'm not saying he's sweet and innocent in any of this, but for whatever reason, his brothers are jealous of him. Jealous. You guys starting to see a little pattern here? Joseph's brothers are jealous. Daniel's rivals are jealous. Jealousy has no place in good leadership. Just like Portia talked about this morning, we all have strengths. And a good leader knows that. A good leader knows that I have my strengths, she has her strengths, you have your strengths, and I am not I am not going to be thinking that you're better than me or I'm better than you. Jealousy has no place in good leadership. And I'm going to stick with what I'm good at and let you stick at what you're good at. And hopefully bring you into my circle so we can both look really good. That's good leadership. So in the story found in Genesis 37, 12 through 36, you can read it whenever you get a chance. I'm just going to sum it up to you. Joseph is asked by his dad to go check on his brothers in the field. Again, he's a favorite. Brothers are off working in the field. Joseph's home. So he goes, and as he's walking toward the brothers, they see him from a distance, and they're like, there's Joseph the dreamer. Let's kill him. Now, I'm thinking there had to have been some stuff happening in their middle that caused them to come to this point, let's kill him. You don't just, I mean, some of you might, I don't know your brothers, but some of you might have thought that, there he is in the morning again, let's kill him. I mean, you just don't really have that thought usually. If you do, there will be some altar time later. I really recommend you come up and get that right with the Lord. But his older brother, Reuben, who gets brother of the year, says, let's not kill him. Let's throw him in the well. Let's just throw him away. Thinking he was going to come back later and get him. So that's what they do. Sure enough, Joseph comes. They strip him of his robe. Gets thrown in the well, the whatever it's called. And these brothers, the Bible says, sit down and have lunch. Talk about savage, right? They throw their brother in a pit, and then they sit down and eat. Hey, can you pass the hummus? I mean, like, and as they're eating, this group of merchants come by, and they're like, we should get some money for this guy. And they sell him. They sell him into slavery for $6.29. $6.20, sorry, not no nine. That's kind of the how much they said it would be worth today. $6.20. $6.20, that's like, cost of a gallon of gas. It's not that much, right? And so I'm just saying, I just don't think that these brothers got to that point in their life that day. There had to have been some pent-up emotions coming from them in their own middles, and we're going to get to that in a second. But before then, let's get back into Joseph. As we read the story, he was taken to Egypt, where we know two of things happened as he's eventually, through a series of events, brought to the palace. Number one, he stayed close to God in his middle. And number two, he eventually became second in command of all of Egypt. How? Well, because like I said, he dreams of the future. And he also had the ability, the gift of God, to interpret these dreams. And so Pharaoh, who is the king, has a dream one night, a dream about cows and grain. Again, you can read about this in its entirety in Genesis 41. But in this dream, the king, the Pharaoh, is standing next to the Nile, and he sees these seven cows that the Bible calls attractive. Like, I've never looked at a cow and thought, there's a good-looking heifer. You know, I mean, why is it called attractive and plump cows? Whatever. And then he sees seven more cows that are the exact opposite. They're ugly and they're skinny. Come on, ladies. We are striving for we should just be proud of our fat and plump COVID-19 that we have gained selves, right? Let's just embrace it. That's what the Bible says. Fat and attractive, plump and attractive, not skinny and ugly. Okay, I'm getting off my notes. So he sees these cows, the seven attractive cows and the seven unattractive cows, and then he wakes up. The Bible just says he wakes up. He must have been startled, like, oh my gosh, these cows are so ugly, and he wakes up. That's all the Bible says. He wakes up, and then he falls asleep again, and he dreams a second time. This time, he dreams about seven ears of grain that is, again, attractive. It says, literally, good-looking and plump. And then he sees seven ears of grain come up, sprout up, and devour the seven ears of good-looking grain. Ebenezer Scrooge, anybody, any fans of them? He has nothing on this guy. I mean, a bit of beef. I don't know what he was eating the night before. Thai pizza, that's what I had last night, and I had some crazy dreams. But nothing like this. So anyways, King Pharaoh tells this dream to his wisest of men, who usually can interpret his dreams. And they're like, we got nothing. Like, I don't know what you're talking about here. And so upon the cupbearer, his cupbearer's recommendation, a cupbearer is just someone who, his only job is to take a drink and eat a bite of food before the king. If he falls dead, the king shouldn't eat it. Talk about a great job, right? Job security? No. So the cupbearer just so happened to come from jail. You can read about that, why he was in jail. And he was in jail with Joseph. Read about that too. I'm not going to go into that. But the cupbearer, trust me, the cupbearer and Joseph had been in jail together. And as the king is explaining his dream, the cupbearer is listening and he's seeing that nobody can interpret it. And he's like, hey, I know a guy. Because he was in jail with Joseph and Joseph had interpreted the dream that he had just had. And it came true. Don't tell me that God wastes anything in your middle. And so upon his recommendation, they bring Joseph before Pharaoh. Pharaoh tells him his dream, and with God's help, Joseph is able to interpret his dream and tell him what he is supposed to do because of that dream, including the appointing of overseers to gather all the food of the good years that are coming and store up the grain as a reserve for the land so that Israel or Egypt would not perish in this famine. A good leader relies on the Lord for their wisdom and not their understanding. A good leader relies on the Lord for their wisdom and not their own understanding. And so, of course, Pharaoh is so pleased with Joseph and his discerning and wise spirit, he appoints him as second in command. Genesis 41, 39 through 44. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he made him ride in the second chariot, and they called out before him, bow the knee. Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. He gave this guy some power. He's sold into slavery. He stays close to God. And here he is second in command because he stayed close to God and he listened to him for wisdom. So Joseph oversees the gathering of food for 7 years and puts the food in every city, which is a good thing because there's 7 years of surplus. And then just like he said, there would be 7 years of famine. And the Bible says that this famine was in all the land, everywhere, all the lands, not just Egypt. It was everywhere. But because of Joseph's interpretation of this dream, they were in a position where people could come and buy the food, and so they didn't starve in Egypt. And so Joseph ended up saving a lot of lives. And the story goes on to say that his brothers eventually came to Egypt because they were starving, and so they came to Egypt for food. And what happens? They bow down before Joseph, just like Joseph read, just like Joseph said in his dream would happen. And when they bow down to him, instead of Joseph wanting them to get their due, wanting them to feel a little bit, what is his response? His response is one of kindness and great humility. And he says one of my favorite verses, Genesis 50, 20 through 21. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done in saving many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. See what God did here? Through all of the things that Joseph's brothers did to him, through all of it, he was working. Even when I don't see it, you're working. And he was working to save an entire nation from starvation. So how can we be intentional in our middle? When we want others to get their due? As good leaders, we need to learn to forgive and let God work it all out on our behalf. I never said it was going to be easy. I never said being a good leader is easy. But somehow Joseph was able to work through his feelings of betrayal and discouragement and imprisonment to a position of authority. And somehow, through all of it, he not only saved the nation, but he saved his very brothers that brought him to imprisonment in the first place. This is huge for us for so many reasons, because as we walk through the circumstances of our life, the middles of our life, we must trust God with our tomorrows. We must trust God with our tomorrows and remember that what the enemy intends for evil, for harm, God intends for good. Joseph's response was one of respect and relationship, because good leadership rests on two factors, respect and relationship. What would Joseph say to us as he's being led away in chains, sold into slavery by his brothers? I believe he would say to us, trust. Trust his plan. Trust him in the middle. The story of Joseph is such a good reminder for us as leaders to trust what God is doing in our middle. But as leaders, we must also learn the lesson from his brothers. Like his brothers, we all have moments in our life, in our days, of offense. Some big, some little. And these offenses, if we don't deal with them accordingly, will slip by, and over time, they'll fester, and they'll turn into jealousy, and anger, and resentment. And we will go from a normal day, just working in the field, to a day where we are plotting to kill our own brother. Let's look back a little bit at Joseph's brothers. Because of their jealousy and hatred for Joseph, they wanted to get revenge on him because he was the favorite, because he lorded it over them. He didn't handle things right. He was wrong. He wasn't right in that. But because of their offense to it, they sold him into slavery, and thus they sent him down a quest that would eventually end with an entire nation, the nation of Israel, in oppression, as slaves in Egypt. Because of Joseph's fine work, so because they sent him down this quest, and because of Joseph's fine work in helping Pharaoh through the famine to gather the food and put Pharaoh in a position where he could sell the food to these people. But remember, the food isn't free. So remember that part. We'll get into that in a second. And couple all of that with the fact that Joseph's brothers and his family eventually moved to Egypt. Pharaoh loved Joseph so much that he gave his family land in Egypt to settle in. Couple all of this together and the actions that were set forth when these brothers sold their brother into slavery, it all began to have consequences. Let me explain. People didn't have food. People didn't have food during this famine, and they didn't have money, but they had land. And eventually they had to do what they had to do to get food. In Genesis 47, 19 through 20, it says, "Why should we perish before your eyes?" It's people talking to Joseph. "Why should we perish before your eyes? We and our land as well. Buy us, and in exchange we will for food, and we with our land will be in bondage to Pharaoh. Give us seed so that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become desolate." So Joseph bought all the land in Egypt for Pharaoh. The Egyptians, one and all, sold their fields because the famine was too severe for them. And the land became Pharaoh's. That last sentence is huge. The land became Pharaoh's. Ever wonder why the Israelites were slaves in Egypt for so long? It's because the land that they were living in, that they had settled in, eventually became Pharaoh's. Jacob, who brought his family to Egypt to settle, whose name would eventually be what? Israel. The land they were living in became Pharaoh's. And it was fine for a while because Pharaoh loved Joseph. So he loved his family. But eventually, just like everyone, this Pharaoh died. And here come the consequences of the actions of a few boys on that day that they sold their brother. Exodus 1, 8 through 11. "Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power over Egypt. He said to his people, 'Look at the Israelite people, more numerous and stronger than we are. Come, let's deal with them wisely. Otherwise, they will continue to multiply, and if a war breaks out, they will ally themselves with our enemies and fight against us and leave the country.' So they put foremen over the Israelites to oppress them with hard labor, and as a result, they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for the Pharaoh. A new king who knew nothing of Joseph, looks over his land, because remember, it's all his. They sold all of their land to Pharaoh's. It was all his. And he looks out and he sees all these Israelites living in his land, and he becomes threatened. And for an entire nation of Israel, they have to suffer under his regime, his oppression, his hard labor. They become his slaves for centuries. The course of a nation was changed. History was changed because one day some brothers got offended and acted out on their offense. Their offense grew to envy and then anger and then revenge that caused them to do the unthinkable. They sold their brother into slavery, and that affected their great-grandchildren's lives, their great-grandchildren's lives, and their great-grandchildren's lives, and so on and so on. The moment these brothers allowed themselves to act on their offense, their jealousy, their anger, the course of a nation changed in a moment. These Israelites became slaves. It became the start of Exodus, the story we all love, right? The song we sing, "Let My People Go." I mean, it all happened because these brothers got offended. Don't think for a second that our decisions that we make, especially in jealousy, especially in anger, especially in frustration, do not matter. They do matter. And they can affect you forever and your children and their children. And so as leaders, we must be intentional with our offenses. We must be intentional about not being an offended in our middle. And if we are, to deal with them quickly and accordingly with God. Proverbs 19:11 says, "Good sense makes one slow to anger, and it's in his glory to overlook an offense." Good leaders are quick to forgive. If you want to do a good leadership check, a self-leadership check, ask yourself, am I holding on to an offense? Because if you are, it could wreak havoc in you, in your family, and in your leadership. And just when you forgive, it doesn't mean you forget. Remember that. It just means that you trust God to deal with it, and you no longer are looking for your own revenge. You're no longer looking to see what you can get out of it. You're saying, "God, I'm giving it to you. I give it to you." But what about when you're stuck in the middle and it's important what you do? So here we are, because of Joseph's brothers, here we are with a whole bunch of Israelites, hundreds of years later, stuck in slavery. Enter Moses. And he would come into his middle after he had just pleaded with God to let his people go. "Let my people," I mean, just, it's a fun song. Just sing it. You go way down there and get up, you know. And because of his persuasion and God's persuasion, and by persuasion I mean in the form of boils and blood, frogs, locusts. You can read it all in its entirety in Exodus chapter 7 through 11. We find Pharaoh has a change of heart, and he decides that Moses can indeed let his people go, so he can lead them out of slavery. They can lead them out of Egypt. And as they're leaving, Pharaoh has another change of heart. The Bible says that God hardened his heart, and he decided he wanted those people back. So he gathers all of his people, he gathers all of his chariots, and they start chasing after the Israelites. And the Israelites find themselves at the Red Sea with nowhere to go, and the Egyptians coming after them. This is where we find Moses, stuck as a leader. He is stuck. And what does he do as a leader? He speaks to his people. He says in Exodus 14:14, "The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." Let's go to the Israelites' middle for a second there, shall we? Like, think about it. Like, seriously, put yourself in their position. They are standing on the bank of the Red Sea, nowhere to go, and they turn around, they see the Egyptians coming with all they got. And Moses says, "Just be still. The Lord will fight for you." But what is, first of all, let me just go back to kind of what Portia was saying this morning. We as leaders cannot rely on our own understanding. Just because it works one way one day does not mean that it will work the same way the next day. We must rely on the Lord for his understanding, his knowledge, his wisdom every single time. Look at the miracles in the Bible. Usually they're not the same. Sometimes you spit in the mud. Sometimes you go down seven times. Sometimes you throw your staff down and it becomes a serpent. I mean, it's never the same. And so just because you think it worked so one time, you should do it that way every time? No. You have to rely on the Lord's wisdom every single time. Do not rely on your own understanding. That is a side note. I'm going to get back to my notes. So the very next verse, after Moses tells his people to be still, is verse 15. And here's what verse 15 says. And I just love the way the Lord works. Then the Lord says to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move." He's like, "You guys, run. The Israelites are coming after you. Don't just stand there. Go." And Moses, being the leader he is, knowing whose confidence his confidence is in, follows the orders of God and eventually parts the sea. Talk about a miracle in the middle. And he leads his people to safety because of his obedience as a leader. His obedience. Because here's the thing. It's not the method that brings about the miracle. It's obedience. It is not your method. It is not a method we can conjure up because it worked the first time that brings about a miracle. It is your obedience. And because of his obedience, God uses him to gather his people across the Red Sea to safety, to delivery. Yes, there's a time to be still. Like Daniel, when there was nothing he could do. But then there is times, I mean, it would be absurd for the Israelites to vocalize their trust in God and not utilize their God-given legs to hustle across the Red Sea. There are times where we need to be still, but there are times where we must take the next step. And our job as leaders is to know the difference. Our job as leaders is to ask God, what's my next step? What would Moses say to us if he could talk to us as Egyptians, as the Egyptians were coming and approaching them and they had nowhere to go? I believe that he would say, trust. Trust that God will give you the next step if it's yours to take. The middle is hard, it's terrifying, it's messy, it's unfair. But you can't have a miracle without the middle. You can't have a miracle without a middle. I want to end with a story about my sweet Sophie. I'm kind of biased about the worship team, but I'm really biased about the two girls that are singing. They're mine. And Sophie is the one over here. And I want to tell you a story about Sophie that brought me through three of these middles, all three of these middles, where it was important what I did, where I wanted others to get their due, and where there was nothing I could do. A few years ago, when Sophie was 12 years old, she started complaining of hip pain. And it was weird because sometimes she was fine, running around like a normal kid, and then other times she was in extreme pain and crying. She would be walking along, and she would just trip, be on the floor. And now she gets her grace from her mom. I'm not clumsy. The floor is just out to get me. The tables and chairs are bullies, and the wall just gets in my way. And she's like that, too. And so as good parents, when she would trip, we would laugh at her. Real good parents here. And the pain continued, and so we had this bright idea that we should take her to the doctor. And so we did, and he kind of felt the same way. He's like, you know, I don't think it's anything. I think it's growing pains or something called bursitis. I still don't know what that is. Maybe Kristen knows, Dr. Kristen, she can tell me later. Something called bursitis. And sent her home. And she continued. The pain continued, and it continued to get worse and worse and worse. And so we took her back, and they did an MRI, and they sent us home and said that they would give us a call at the end of the week with the results. So we went home, and I started to get worried about this because of the pain that she was in. Now, a little backstory on Sophie. We started the church when she was 3 years old, and we planted in September. And at the end of September, we were tearing down on a Sunday. Now, when you plant a church, you're portable usually, so you set up and then you tear down the same day. So we were tearing down, and this 8-foot table, while she was running by, caught something and fell on her little leg and broke it. And she barely cried. The next month, October 30th to be exact, we were doing a bonfire, and Sophie wanted to go out and be with her daddy while he was getting it started, so I sent her out, and he tells the story like this. He said, I watched her coming toward me. She's walking in a little boot, and she's looking out over the pond, not paying attention where she was going. And in his mind, in most people's mind, you think, surely they're going to eventually look to see where they're walking. She didn't. She tumbled right into the fire. he pulled her out and brought her in right away, and I could see she had gotten, I mean, her hair is sticking straight up, like, you know, just crazy. She's got burns on her nose, on her mouth, on her chin, and her hand. So we took her to the doctor, and she had second-degree burns all over her mouth, her nose, her hand. He got her bandaged up and medicated up and took her home. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and she's sitting at the kitchen counter with me as I'm trying to kind of get everything settled for bed and getting her whatever she needed, her medication and all that stuff. And she says, and the doctors had said to us, you know, because of her burns around her mouth, she probably won't be able to eat solid food for at least 2 weeks. So she's sitting at the counter as I'm getting everything ready, and she says, "Mommy, I'm hungry." She's always hungry when she was little. She was so cute. But she was hungry. And before I could even think about what to make for her, she sees a saltine cracker sitting on the counter, grabs it, and starts eating it, and then started eating another one. Between that and her not even crying as I would change her bandages, I knew this little girl had a high pain tolerance. The next couple of months after that, December 26th to be exact, why social services or child protection didn't come to our house, I have no idea. Another miracle in the middle, probably. But we were down at Doug's parents. It was Christmas night, but it was December 26th. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. The cousins from Seattle had just flown in, so we were letting the kids play downstairs while us adults, who's in charge, were upstairs talking. Unbeknownst to me, mother of the year here, my son, who you heard about last night, and his two cousins are taking Sophie and throwing her into pillows. They miss the third time. And she comes up to me upstairs, holding her little hand, her little arm, and she says, "Mommy, my arm hurts." She takes her hand away, and I can see it buckling. I can tell it's broken. She's not even crying. She's like, "Mommy, my arm hurts." And so off we go to the ER again, 3 o'clock in the morning, and they go to take her x-ray because they have to see if it's broken. I mean, clearly it's broken. But they go to take the x-ray, and they say, "Okay, Sophie, it's time for your picture." And she looks up, and she says, "Cheese." Nothing affected this little girl. She had such a high pain tolerance until now, until her hip. And so I knew something had to have been wrong, but I just didn't know what. So here we are. The end of that week, she was supposed to go on a field trip, and she has FOMO like her father. If it were me, I'm like an introvert. Introverts unite, alone, anybody with me. But she would have had FOMO, so she's begging to go. She wants to go. "Please, Mommy, can I please go?" So much against my own better judgment, I'm like, "Sure, you can go. But be careful and stay close to your teachers." Okay. About an hour in, I get a phone call. Sophie had been running through the woods, tripped over a log, and she had fallen, and she was crying inconsolably. As I'm talking to the teacher, my husband jumps in the car and just starts going toward her. And he calls me a little bit later on their way home, and he's like, "It took 45 minutes just to get her from where she was into the car because she's in so much pain." He said, "Should I bring her home? Should I bring her to the emergency room? Should we go back to the doctor that we were just at? What should I do?" And I said, "Let me make a few phone calls, and I'll let you know." So I hang up the phone, and I'm feeling panicked. I'm like, "What do I do? Oh, my gosh, we are terrible parents. What have we done?" And I didn't know if this was a new pain from falling. I didn't know if this was a typical pain from her hip. I just didn't know. I didn't have any wisdom. I didn't have anything. And I was seriously unsure of my mothering abilities at this moment. So I called the doctor's office that we had been to earlier in that week. And, of course, my doctor wasn't in. So I talked to a different doctor, and he said, let me check the MRI, and I'll get right back to you." He calls me back in 3 minutes, and he says, "This isn't good. She shouldn't even be on her leg. She shouldn't even be walking from what I'm looking at on this MRI." And I'm like, "Well, nobody told us. Nobody called us. And now it's even worse because not only was she walking, but she fell on it." Talk about wanting somebody to get their due. I was like, "Where, who, what?" And so I said, "What should I do? Should I bring her to you? Should we go to the ER?" He said, "Let me make a few phone calls and I'll get back to you." At this point, Doug is about 5 minutes from home, and he's like, "Where do I take her?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And I hung up the phone with him, and I said, literally, I said, "God, where do I take her?" And I prayed that prayer, and I kid you not, the phone starts ringing. Now, it's an unknown phone call, and I don't answer those. I send them to voicemail. It's the way I am. The best time to call me is text. I just don't answer them. But for some reason, I answered this phone call. And when I answered it, this man on the other end says, "Is this Sophie's mom?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, this is Dr. So-and-so. I'm a surgeon from Gillette Children's Hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I need you to bring me Sophie immediately." He said he was looking at the MRI, and he needed to see her immediately. He proceeded to tell me the directions to get to Gillette. He told me what parking garage to park in, what floor to park on, the number to call, so that the nurse could come out and help get her into the hospital. That's a great story, right? Beginning, middle, end. I prayed to God, where do I take her? And he answers by way of a surgeon. But that is just the middle of my story. See, we didn't know this, but when we got to the hospital, this doctor who I talked to started telling me about how dire this situation is. He explained her situation that when he was looking on the MRI, he said, "Here's what's happening. Your hip is, it resembles an ice cream cone." And he said, "What was happening is, like, on a hot day, an ice cream cone can kind of melt a little bit and slip." And he said, "This is what was happening in her hip, just with the MRI." He said, "Just seeing the MRI like this, I would have wanted to see her immediately. But now we have this fall." And he said, "We don't know what this fall did. And this could have brought on dire circumstances." And he said, "We're not going to go into that because I'm not sure if it's even that." But he said, "Depending on if the hip is broken or not, her blood may not be getting to her bone and her bone could be dying." He said, "Because of a few reasons. One, I don't know if this is what I'm dealing with and I need to know before I get her into surgery. And two, we just so happen to be having a doctor flying in for another case who he is a renowned surgeon in this very case," miracle in the middle. "And that, along with the fact that Sophie had eaten at her field trip," he said, "let's wait to do surgery until the next morning. We don't know what we're dealing with, but let's just wait." The next morning, he comes in about 5 o'clock in the morning with another doctor, and he tells me it is the worst case scenario. He said, "Sophie has broken her hip." He said, "It's the same situation with an ice cream cone on a hot day, but in this case, the ice cream cone, the ice cream has fallen completely off, and she has broken, fractured her hip." He said, "We have no idea how long her bone is gone without blood supply. We have no idea if she will need a hip surgery, if she will need hip replacements, what she's going to need in her little future." He said, "One out of every two children that come in with this eventually need a hip replacement before they're 18. He said, we need to get her into surgery immediately. He said, "This could be the first of many surgeries and hip replacements for my little girl." They told us all these things while Sophie's laying in the bed listening. They tell us a whole spiel about surgery, like she can die during surgery, which I found out later you tell everyone. But if you could have seen my little girl's eyes of complete terror as she's listening, and the fact that I allowed this to happen because I didn't do what I was supposed to do as her mom, you would understand the mess that I was in. We walked her back, her in her bed, to surgery. We were able to walk back with her, and I willed myself not to cry, but I was a mess. You mamas can understand what I'm talking about. I was a mess. And then it was time, they gave her something to relax her, and then it was time for her to go back to surgery, and I had to leave my little girl in somebody else's hands. And I can't tell you the mess that I was in, that background music that was playing in my mind. And I was so mad at the doctor for failing us. But if I'm being honest, I was more mad at myself for failing her, because I didn't push hard enough. I didn't do enough. This was my middle. I was overwhelmed with doubts of myself, doubts of God, questions, anger. I was exhausted, and I had so much fear. Fear of her future, fear of the unknown. And I remember sitting in the waiting room away from everybody else, because that's what you do when you're in the middle, right? You isolate. And I was sitting away from everyone else, and I didn't even know how to pray, so I just kept praying, "God, make her okay. Just make her okay. Just make her okay. Just make her okay." My middle, my doubts. We all have middles. We all doubt God's goodness in the middle. I doubted God's goodness. How could he allow this? I doubted the doctors. How could they have missed this? I doubted myself as a mom. How could have I allowed this? Because the middle is lonely. It's isolating. It's mean. It's unfair. It's dark. It's destructive. But do you know who always shows up in our middle? God the Father comes and he sends his Holy Spirit to comfort us. Jesus walks into the room to sit with us. See, no sooner was I yelling out, like literally out loud, just make her okay, just make her okay. I had a word come from the Lord. It was just one word. Again, it wasn't audible, but it could have been. I'm not sure. And it was just trust. Trust, that's all it was. And I was immediately inundated with texts and phone messages from friends who were starting to hear what was going on and family members. And the underlining, overwhelming theme of every one of them was trust. And as I started reading them, I was reminded of when Sophie was 3 years old and how Satan tried to take us out of the game by using her, tried to take her out of the game. And as I started thinking about it, God said to me, I didn't let him take her then, and I will not let him take her now. And I can't tell you again, that soundtrack that changed, it was like this overwhelming peace, and I knew she was going to be okay. I just knew it. I knew that she had a future of unknown. Nothing changed in our situation, but I had a peace in knowing God's got her. The surgeons came out, and they told us that everything, the surgery was a success. And as he was talking, the surgeon that I had talked to in the original phone call, I noticed he had a little cross necklace hanging out of his collar. That doesn't just happen. You don't just wear that as a fashion accessory in downtown St. Paul. And so I said to him, well, I'm not surprised. I've been praying while you were in surgery, and I believe that God had his hand on this. And he looked at me and he said, Mom, I hope it's okay. But before I even started to cut on your little girl, I prayed over her. And he said, and we placed her on the surgery table, and everything fell back into place. He said, we didn't have to manipulate anything, which could have caused further damage to the capillaries and the bones, the blood supply, and all of that. A miracle in the middle. And I realized in that moment that though I had to take my little girl out of my hands, she never left the Lord's. She was always in his hands. They told us that she would probably need more surgeries. This is the first of many. That she'd probably need a complete hip replacement by the time she was 18. They wouldn't know the extent of the damage except just through time and time alone. It was a wait and see sort of thing. They didn't know if the bone would stay viable. The doctors told us that she would have to be on crutches for at least 8 months to a year. And she started going to her weekly appointments. And 3 months later, the doctor was shocked as he looked at her MRI. And he said, she doesn't even need crutches anymore. I have a post. I have a Facebook picture of her. She hates this picture, but I don't care because this just shows God's goodness. A whole post. You're looking at a girl who just got the all clear without crutches. The x-ray today confirmed the results of her MRI showing good blood flow. Leave that up there. If you guys want to read it, you can read it. It just speaks of God's goodness, of his faithfulness. No matter what happens, no matter when you get your miracle in the middle. She continued on with her monthly appointments, and the doctors were continually amazed at her recovery and her healing. And at her 1 year appointment, he told her she was fine. She was free to go about being a normal kid with no physical activity restrictions. And here we are. Sophie just turned 18. She's standing right back there on the original hip that God gave her. Yeah. She's not had to have one surgery since that initial surgery. She was not that one in two kid that needed a hip replacement by the time she was 18. Whose report should we believe? And see, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the way the miracle unfolds. She got her miracle. Even if she would have had a hip replacement, I know God would have still been in it. He would have still been working it all out on our behalf. He's working it all out to save a nation. His glory, his story is for always to save a nation, to save people, to bring people to him, to bring glory to him. A miracle. But you can't have a miracle without the middle. The middle that we don't want to go through. The middle that we hate. But if you are walking through a middle, just wait. Your miracle is coming. Will you stand with me? I know life sometimes seems bleak and hard. And that background music that you're listening to is harsh and it's daunting. COVID, cancer, accidents, illness, depression, anxiety, marital problems, family problems, health problems. Sometimes the report is horrible. Trust. Sometimes it feels like nothing is going to be normal again. Trust. Sometimes it feels like you're not going to get your answer that you've been pleading with God over and over and over again, that private pain. Trust. Trust him. God is good in the middle. God is with us in the middle. God's got this in the middle. Are you stuck? Are you in the middle? You are in good company. You are in the company of Daniel. You are in the company of Joseph. You are in the company of Moses. You are in the company of Jesus as he hung on the cross and felt forsaken. You are in the company of that and so many others who once were stuck in their middle, but they walked out victorious. Trust him. You are in a place where God can and will show up. Have faith. God is in the middle. Trust him. Your miracle is coming. Endure a little longer, knowing that the end to this middle has to come. It's the very definition of the word middle, being neither at the beginning nor at the end of a series of events. But you can't have a miracle without a middle. Will you bow your heads with me? This response is threefold. Maybe you're here and you're saying you're stuck in the middle and there's nothing you can do about it and you're just waiting for God to show up. Will you raise your hand if you're there? I want to pray with you. Maybe you're in a place and you're stuck in the middle because of someone else's actions and you're holding on to a fence. That's a big one. I'm not even going to ask you to raise your hands because that's a personal one, but I want to pray with you. Or maybe you're here and you're stuck in your middle and you are asking God what your next step is because you need his wisdom. Will you raise your hand so I can pray with you? Father God, I just pray, Lord, as you see all of these hands, and unlike me, Lord, who doesn't know each of these ladies' stories, you do. You know their middle. You know what brought them to their middle. You know how they feel, what they're working on, what they're working out, what they're striving for. And God, you know how their middle will end. And so I'm asking that you would show up and show off and give them the miracle that they're waiting for. I'm asking that you will help us to learn to trust you in the midst of all of it. Amen. We've talked about three very important things this weekend. We talked about abiding. Portia talked about surrendering. And now we're talking about trusting. And I believe these three things are imperative to a Christian leader. All of these are choices that we must be intentional on. Abiding, trusting, surrendering, they're all action verbs. And so they all require an action on your part. They're all individual things. It's something nobody else can do for you. It's something only you can do. It's something only God can show up in. Nobody can conjure up a miracle. Can't. But on those three things, abiding, surrendering, and then trusting, God will show up. I believe it. And so tonight, as we end this time together, I'm asking that you would do an action. I know as leaders, it's hard for us to do this. I get it. But I'm still asking that in faith, you would step out. Again, whether it's coming to the altar, which I really would love it if you did. We have prayer teams coming who have the yellow lanyards. They want to pray with you. But I'm asking that you would come to the altar and have some time with God. Have a one-on-one conversation, a heart-to-heart with Jesus. Tell him what's going on. See, we know that he already knows it, so we don't think we have to say it out loud. We don't have to speak it because God already knows. But here's the thing. When you speak out what you're looking for, when you speak out, when you ask God for his wisdom, when you ask him for whatever it is that you are needing, and he comes in with the answer, whether it's through a person, whether it's through a word from the Lord, whether it's through the Bible, whether it's through circumstances, your faith begins to build. When you speak it out and he comes through, your faith begins to build. And then you learn to trust. And then you learn to trust and then trust, because trust is like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it becomes. And so if you are stuck and you are just waiting for God to show up, or if you're stuck because of something someone else has done, or you're stuck and you need an answer from the Lord, I'm asking you that as these guys lead us, that you would come and you would talk to him and you would worship him, you would abide in him, and that you would let his Spirit lead you, that you would not take another step until the Spirit tells you what the step is, that if he tells you to stay, that you're going to stay. If he says go, go. If he says